Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
David Schultz is a constitutional law professor. He joins us on occasion here on WGN Radio. He's at Hamline University. He's the author of the upcoming The Role Generations Play in American Politics, or something like that. David, what's the title of your book? Good morning. How are you?
Hi, the title is The Role of Generations in American Politics, and what it's going to look at is how across different generations, you know, baby boomers, millennials, Gen Xs, and so forth like that, how do the politics and political attitudes vary, and what's going to happen over the next few years as, I gracefully say, the baby boomers exit the political system and are replaced by another generation.
I guess it begs the question, will the younger people who tend to be more liberal and therefore more democratic, will they age the same way their parents did, and you'll just have another generation of conservative traditional Republicans? Is that what you're sort of hinting at there?
Not necessarily. That with so many things in life where when we're adolescents, we're kind of imprinted, you know, for the rest of our life. There's pretty good evidence that most of us, the political attitudes that we form in our adolescence, whatever the heck we mean by adolescence now, and there's a big debate, for most of us, that stays with us for the rest of our life. And so that that people across generations, some do become more conservative when they get older, but for the most part, most of us stay fixed where we were when we're roughly, I don't know, 18, 19 years old in terms of our basic political orientations.
I suppose we get more steadfast in them, though, because I am thinking now of some angry Democrats and some angry Republicans, and there is no getting them off the dime now that they're 70 or now that they're 80. But maybe a 20 or 30-year-old is more fungible, huh?
Possibly, yes, you're right. We become clearly more set in our views and more convinced and firm in them as we get older. A few exceptions here and there, but for the most part, I think your description is very accurate.
Well, so baby boomers are conservative and Gen Xers are more liberal, right? Or Gen Z. I mean, were there any surprising breakouts in your research on this, David?
Well, what we found is that, a couple things. One, that we clearly know that Gen Z and the millennials are significantly more liberal on a whole range of issues than are the baby boomers, for example. But of course, there are exceptions that even within generations, there are people who are male versus female, different races, different religions, and so forth. And so we can't ignore those issues or our class backgrounds like that. But in general, we can say that the demographics right now are suggesting a more liberal politics in the future. But contrary to what Democrats think, where they used to say demographics are destiny, I always say demographics are possibilities. And to win elections, you still have to have what? A good candidate, a good strategy, a good message, a whole bunch of other things. So just having demographics doesn't guarantee you're going to be the victor.
I also think, and this is not why I called, so we'll leave this, but it is kind of fascinating, right, that it's not just age, but it is, if you're speaking demographics, it's nationality or race. I think that as America becomes more blended, both parties need to pay attention to that.
That's exactly the message I think that's out there, that America is going to look very different in the next 10 to 15 years than it did for the first 230 years. And both parties need to recognize that.
And I don't think that's a slam dunk for Democrats either. I have a friend who's a pastor and has a sizable community listening to him on the south side of Chicago. I'm talking about a black church with the black parishioners, and he's a Republican. He's like, you know what? What have Democrats done for us? He's singing a little bit from Donald Trump's book there when he would say, yep, how's that working out for you guys? What are you, crazy? Give us a try. I think that Democrats need to pay. Look what happened in Miami. They voted for Trump down in the southern part of Florida, for that matter. So it's not a slam dunk, is it?
No, it's not. And again, ignore people at your peril.
Yeah.
I think that will be the message.
So, David, I called you to ask. I didn't realize this. I thought that if the president gets impeached, that he can't run for the president again. That's not the case, right?
It's not necessarily the case. You're right, because my understanding, if you and I were talking a month ago, is that you couldn't impeach and hold a trial for a president after he was no longer president. That was just sort of, to me, received wisdom. And then I went back and realized that back in 1876, there was, they used to call him the Secretary of War then, not the Secretary of Defense. A Secretary of War was impeached, resigned, and the Senate said, well, we can still hold a trial. And then I went back and looked at the Constitution, and it doesn't explicitly say you can't do an impeachment and trial afterwards, although everything that I understood as a constitutional law scholar, everything that I've read, sort of suggested that what? Impeachment and conviction was about removal from office, and then possibly you might be able to do a second vote to be able to bar that person from holding federal office again. But there's a lot of sort of constitutional gray area right now, and the fact that we're going to be holding a trial after Donald Trump is no longer president, that's one of those kind of interesting gray areas that, again, a lot of us thought was this wouldn't have happened, yeah, you know, a month ago.
I'm sorry to hear you use the word sorta, because I think the stakes are high, even though he's no longer the president. I think that it would be nice if we knew exactly what the rules were, what the roadmap is, and it sounds like we don't. But let's just help me out with the things we do know. You can impeach a person a second time, right?
Correct.
And you can impeach him when he's out of office. When you impeach them,
the case now, yep.
And when you impeach them after their term is up, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court does not preside. One of the senators presides. Is that correct?
Correct.
Which is weird to me. I don't know why I'm not sure that a person with a political stripe on them, ultimately they all do, but better a Supreme Court justice to me than a U.S. senator. I think the founding fathers made a mistake when they allowed this quirk in the rules.
Which is why many of us also think that impeachment for the president wasn't supposed to be once he was out of office, because this is such a grave is the word I'm going to use here, such a grave issue here that you do want like an impartial chief justice to oversee it. So the fact that we're going to have an ex-president being tried and one of the jurors is also serving as the judge or the presiding officer, if I can use that analogy, that's very odd to me.
All right. So, David, I understand that actions should have consequences. And therefore, if you feel that one of the consequences of inciting an insurrection should be impeachment, then so be it. You have to pay the price. But I worry the flip side of that is we're now going to start to use impeachments punitively. We're now going to impeach a lot of presidents whenever we really feel they've done something outrageous. And it might even include wearing a tan suit. Do you think that we've lowered the bar a little bit, that we've sort of diluted the significance of the impeachment with this second impeachment of Donald Trump?
It's possible. I mean, the fact that we've never gotten a conviction for a president, and in the entire history, we've only had about 7 or 8 convictions, you know, for federal judges and so forth. The bar seems to be pretty high in terms of it. But here I worry about the idea of saying that, you know, person is out of office, the political solution has already been affected. What do I mean by political solution? The public voted him out of office, and now we want to go and put him on trial. That sounds, you know, not normally like what American democracy would be. If I were waving my magic wand, what I would have preferred to see here in many ways would have been what? The House and the Senate vote to just censure him. Now, people are going to say that's not really a punishment, but guess what? It would have been probably bipartisan, and it would go in the history books of saying that a president was censured for what he said that, you know, that encouraged an insurrection or whatever you want to call it, you know, at the Capitol. And I think that would be good.
Two more questions for you. Which of the impeachments do you think has more constitutional might?
Of all the ones that have occurred?
No, the two of Donald Trump. Which do you think is more legitimate? Which has the more constitutional muster?
for constitutional muster. The first one because he was still in office, and that had the Senate found that he had committed an impeachable offense, it would have been he would have been removed from office. And that seems to be closer to what I think the framers intended the impeachment process to be.
It would seem to me like inciting an insurrection to overthrow the legitimately elected or about to be elected government is the purest form of not upholding the Constitution. It would be the second of the two. I mean, one article of impeachment. It's real simple. Watch it. Here's the whole trial. Hey, did you see that thing on TV? What do you think? Trial's over.
I mean, from the point of view of substantively, I think you're right. From a process point of view, I think the first impeachment was cleaner.
Fair enough. And then finally, I got 30 seconds here, David, but 2/3 of the Senate needs to convict. If, and this is where it gets a little gray maybe, but if he can't run for office, that might be a second vote, and that might require a simple majority or a supermajority. Do you know?
I still think, and most of us think, it requires a supermajority. There are past history when this has happened for people not the president, it's always been super majorities. I know there are a couple of legal scholars saying simple majority. Most of us don't think so.
What an interesting book I'll bet David Schultz has written again. They always are. This time, The Role of Generations in American Politics. David Schultz from Hamline University.